I could not stop crying. Now, for those of you who know me, you're probably thinking, what's new? Of course you were crying. Was it a new Drake song? An Ava DuVernay documentary? A conversation with Trey? Why are you? Of course you're crying. And since we're here, I might as well go ahead and tell you something that you probably already know. From time to time, I've shed a tear or two. I've been known to get a bit emotional. And honestly, since my mom is here as a witness, I guess I really can't hide that anymore, right? It really doesn't matter the occasion, whether happy or sad or excited or pensive or disappointed or nervous or mad. I'll often express my emotion with, you know, a good cry. I mean, I cried when Barack won. I cried when I graduated from Morehouse. I cried when I got into UChicago and Howard. I cried when I was rejected from Georgetown. I cried when I had to quit my last job. I cried when I found out I could come back here. I cried when I got married. I cried when I got ordained. I cry when I read a powerful book here, a new idea here, an intriguing lecture, and even preach a good sermon that I'm moved by. Comes in waves. Let it suffice to say that I'm an emotional guy, and every now and then I cry. So it wasn't that weird that I was crying then, but it still caught me off guard. So here's what happened. We were driving through the city, taking in the sights. We passed by the university and City Hall, through Capitol Hill, the Temple of Justice. We took the scenic route so that we could see a beautiful view of the water. We came down the hill and turned down the street by the jail, and a young man started to run up to the car, but still I didn't notice it much. Then suddenly, the car stopped. I looked outside, and what must have been 50 people were now standing alongside us, singing in our language, dressed in all white, traditional cloth. Throwing rice at the car, I turned back to my mom and sister and asked, "Is this our family?" And the tears running down their faces as they started to run down my own, we were home. In the Republic of Liberia, on Center Street, South Beach, the place where I'd heard about my whole life, about where my parents lived and how they met there and how we had a house there and how, you know, so-and-so, because they grew up there, right there on the beach with us. And so it was a bit emotional to stand there as my family, but such a large family joined us, some of them traveling days on foot just to meet us. And the celebration continued. They pulled us out of the car. They hugged us and kissed us and danced and sang. We must have done this for 20 or 30, 40, 50 minutes. Through technology, we used FaceTime to FaceTime my other sister back in Baton Rouge. We FaceTime my nieces, Giselle and Noelle. We FaceTime Lauren, and we FaceTime other family members. And I was looking around, and the tears continued to fall as I looked at the neighborhood, as I took in the scent. As I examined the poverty, I cried like I hadn't cried before. I needed to sit down on those steps and cry and weep. I looked around me, and the question that I was thinking about, the question that kept moving me to tears, was why was it through the accident of birth and circumstance? Through the accident of birth and circumstance that my life had turned out the way that it had, so far removed from the neighborhood that I was supposed to grow up in. The cousins that I was supposed to grow up alongside, the nieces and nephews that I was supposed to care for, the streets that should have been familiar to me. I couldn't help but think about the war and the poverty and living through the collapse of a nation state and the theft of their adolescence. How do they continue to live as though their life matters? See, I was haunted by this question in that moment as I took in the condition of my neighborhood. I was haunted by this theological question, this moral question. How does one live as though their life matters? It is a question that I had that day in Monrovia, and it is a question that I had at the airport in Amsterdam. It is a question that I had as we rushed through in Penn Station and passed by the homeless men begging for change in the cold New York City weather. It is a question that I have each time I'm in Harlem and Brooklyn as I look at the sign for the apartments that I want to live in right next to the big housing projects. It is the question that I have each time I travel around this country. It is the question, Victoria, I have as we study the African diaspora. How do these people live as though their lives matter? Is a question that I have when I think about hip-hop. When I think about rappers like Nipsey Hussle, who died a week ago today to violence. Who, when he said, red rose in the gray pavement. Young black brother, and I can't change it. He knows that he's a genius. He just can't claim it because they left him no platforms to explain it. So deep down, he's frustrated, so he gets faded, but he knows that he can't stay faded. How long, he asks, should I stay dedicated? How long until opportunity meets preparation? They left him no platforms to explain it. How long should I stay dedicated? How long until opportunity meets preparation? This question is a question of how can I live as though my life matters? And this question is the subject of the Lenten lie that we deal with this morning. See, we get the first glimpse of it in Scripture, in the gospel lesson. The first part of the text says that those who love their lives will lose it, and those who hate their lives will keep it. And at first glance, it seems like the scripture is saying that our lives ultimately don't matter. And far too often, Maria, people run to churches that sell them the lie and the promise that because heaven exists, that the things that happen here don't really matter. They say God will ultimately work everything out, so accept your condition. Yeah, that's right. Accept your status. Accept the world as it is. And so for too many people, week after week and day after day and hour after hour after hour, they live through hell with no heaven in sight. And a text like this, Jeremy, can have us wondering, like Nicodemus last week, how can these things be? Are we supposed to hate our lives? What about the conditions of this world, the pain in this world, the violence in this world, the disaster in this world, the exploitation in this world? Are we just supposed to steal away and wait for that chariot that's coming to take us home? These are the questions that we must ask today, and these are the questions that our ancestors asked. Yes. They put it this way. They said, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows, we hung up our harps. For there our captors asked us for a song, and our tormentors asked us for mirth, saying, sing us one of those songs of Zion. But how could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither, let my tongue cling to my mouth. Psalm 37 was written during the Babylonian exile or shortly after they came back. It was written, and maybe as a reflection of what happened when the Babylonians marched into Jerusalem destroyed the temple, took all of the leaders, the priests, the scribes, the intellectuals, the teachers, the lawyers, the musicians, the artists, the rabbis, the healers, the poets, the activists, the griots, the truth tellers, the story tellers, the elders. And they deported them. Sound familiar from their own land? They held them in exile. They closed the border on them. And then they mocked them and tortured them and pressured them to sing, and not just any song, one of those songs of Zion. See, Lauren, they studied their culture just enough to exploit it. They knew what a song of Zion was. They knew that it was supposed to be a praise song, a joyful song, a song that could only be sang in Jerusalem. So they mocked them. They said, sing us one of those songs while you're in your captivity. In other words, they were mocking them. They're saying, live as though your life matters, even though you're in captivity. And this question, how do we live as though our lives really matter? How do we live as though our traditions, our customs, our rituals, the belief systems that were indigenous to us, the truths that we have held on to our whole lives, how do we live as though our lives matter? How do we live in exile, in Babylon, longing for the sound, smell, taste and feel of home? My friends, don't miss the depth in this question. Don't miss the depth in this question, especially as they ask it, how do I live under these conditions, be they empire or the ghetto or colonialism or corporate America or academia or white racism or colorism or a failed state or xenophobia or sexism or homophobia or the collapse of my industry? How do I know that my life matters under these conditions is the fundamental question of faith. And if I can push it further, they raise this particular question and seek a particular answer to this question that has universal significance. See, this is part of why we study the Bible. It's because we believe that a particular people with a particular problem might raise a particular issue that might help us discover an answer that liberates us all. I'll say that again. A particular people with a particular problem might raise a particular issue, and that the answer to that particular issue might liberate us all. See, if we really want to understand how does my life matter, how do I make sense of my life, even if my life is as a white, upper middle class, well-educated person that has privileges in this world and perhaps feels trapped between knowing you have privileges and seeing injustice, and you want to answer this question, then we must study the people who ask this question incessantly. We must study the people and how they ask this question and the process by which they get the answers. We must stop them, hold their hands, and ask them, but wait, how did you not perish in Babylon? How were you able to live and tell the story? See, my friends, the point of liberation theology, whether black or Latin American or queer or womanist or African, is that we are to sit with those who have been mocked and tormented and beaten and abused by Babylon and listen closely to how they found life in the middle of that. See, that is why when a church like ours puts up a Black Lives Matter sign outside, we're making more than a trendy statement. We're proclaiming to the world that we want to be the type of place that sits with those particular people as they grapple with their particular problems. And that the answers to those particular problems might have the power to liberate us all. See, when we put that Black Lives Matter sign on, what we're saying is, yo, how do you black people live as though your life matters when Donald J. Trump is the president? Yeah. And Mike Pence is the vice president? When Kristen Nielsen runs DHS and Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch have the voting power on the Supreme Court? How does your group, a group that includes queer people, and a group that includes women whose rights are taken, and a group that includes undocumented people and farm workers and sex workers and young professionals drowning in student debt, redlined out of neighborhoods and home ownership, being impoverished, and the elderly and the disabled and the working poor and ordinary people, how do you live as though your life matters? How have you found a way to make it? See, when we ask this question to the people of the Bible and the people in society, we find the answer. In Psalm 137, as they lament, they also remember.
Yes.
And in how they remember, they find their answer. See, that is the key to them being able to find life in their conditions. They weep about missing home, but in their weeping, they tell the story of their land, the story of their ancestors, the story of their cultures, their traditions. In the weeping, they keep the story alive.
Yes.
They keep running the marathon. See, let me keep pushing this for a minute. In their weeping, they are practicing what the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Conference called the call to sacred memory. See, the text says, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither, let my tongue cling to my mouth. You need your right hand to play the harp. You need your tongue to tell the story. So if I forget you, O Jerusalem, I can't play my music anymore. I can't tell my story anymore. As they remember Jerusalem, they can play their music, they can tell their story, they can resist Babylon, making sure their song is never lost, their hope is never lost, their history is never lost, their culture is never lost, that they themselves might never be lost. When they remember their families and remember their neighborhoods and remember their song and remember their religion and remember their tradition and remember their food and remember their dance, when they say the names of the fallen, the names of the heroes, the names of the agitators, when they pass the tradition down over and over and over again, when they tell the jokes and the parables, when they point out the nuances and the contradictions, when they construct their world often from memory, they are claiming their freedom. They are telling their story. They are singing their song. See, when I sat on those steps in front of my parents' house on Center Street South Beach, I wasn't just weeping about the conditions that were around me. No, it was deeper than that. I was weeping because I was witnessing my people, my family, my flesh and my blood, seeing how they embody sacred memory. How they embodied living to tell the story, how they embodied being able to find life in their condition, how they were telling their story and literally singing their song. See, everything in my life had prepared me to return to a Liberia that was completely and totally destroyed by war, where no one had anything materially or even spiritually, where folks had nothing to live for, where all hope was lost and abandoned, and all of their dreams were lost. And while this was true for many people, and while there was way too much poverty and too much injustice and too much of that is our fault, much more of what I found were instead large pockets of people who embodied hope. Large pockets of people who were building, creating, constructing, restoring, repairing, socializing, teaching, working, selling, buying, planting, growing, sowing, moving, praying, worshiping, marrying, baptizing, cooking, eating, hustling, participating in politics and sports and learning and finessing and relaxing and dancing and partying and celebrating and living. They were living, they were living, they were living. And in the living, they were remembering. In the living, they were reconstructing. In the living, they were living. And friends, that is the work that we must do.
Yes.
We must live. We must live and we must remember today. Will you live and will you remember? Will you heed the call to sacred memory? Will you look back on your life and ask how far God has taken you and celebrate that? Will you look back on your family story and see how far God has brought you? Will you study, listen to, and remember the stories of others, especially those on the margins of our society who have pieced together a meaningful life under these conditions? Will you submit yourself to their acts of life and sacred memory? And will you stand in solidarity with them as they try to reconstruct and reimagine? Will you push back on the lie that your life, that my life, that their lives, that saying something like black lives don't matter? And instead, will you say with all boldness and clarity that it does? My life matters. Your life matters. Black lives specifically matter. We have to lift them up. And will you always name the conditions and situations and particular pains and oppressions that people see, that we see those people crying out in Babylon? Will you choose to live by remembering, especially those who have gone before us in especially violent and vulnerable ways, with their backs against the walls, with their bodies against the pavement, their humanity under arrest? And will you choose to tell their stories and sing their song so that we might hear the sounds of the God of liberation saying, our liberation is coming all the day long? Will you remember?